Little Emily biting her sister, or is teenage Barry refusing to help around the house? Consulting psychologist David Carey joins us to answer all your parenting woes.
You're very welcome. David Carey, child psychologist and dean at the College of Progressive Education, joins us now to go through some of the questions for our parenting slot. Dave, good to see you again.
Hi, Tom. I'm thrilled to be here.
This day next week will be the day before the schools go back.
Yes.
Would that be peak parenting slot interest?
It could very well be. It's a day of mixed joy and sorrow, you know? Sorrow on the part of the children, joy on the part of the parents.
It depends, though, if it's a child's first day in school. That is a very harrowing experience for parents, isn't it?
It can be difficult, yeah. But most children adjust to it very well. I remember my daughter's first day in school, and it brought her to the school door, and I was all upset and whatnot. Oh, my God, here's my one and only leaving, and she ran into the school and never looked back, never even waved to say goodbye. I was devastated. She was happy.
I just remember not long after them going in, I went in to see them and I talked. I found them talking to their own friends, and it was the first time it struck me that they have their own world now.
Yeah.
I almost felt, how dare you?
We were meant to share them with the greater good.
Yeah, I didn't think we were giving them away that quickly, though. Right, I have to say that the questions coming to you this week are fascinating. I'm dying to hear your issues, your answers, because there's so many issues in them that I can absolutely relate to. Not this one, though. This is about a 16-year-old boy, which is a bit further down the road than I am with my two. So the question is this. Our 16-year-old boy continually gravitates to drifters, lads with little or no ambition. They are generally younger and from challenging backgrounds. We have four kids, all brought up to try their best, to be respectful of themselves and others. We are not competitive or pushy. We just want them to keep an eye on their grades and always on what impression they are giving out. He started primary school, and he went into a group of boys that were disruptive from the get-go. He was always quiet, and this did have an effect on him. He wet the bed until he was 12. Then he went into an all-boys school because he wanted to follow the boys, and it was a disaster from day one. He just joined the lowest common denominator and became problematic at school. We found him smoking and drinking several times. We moved him into a mixed school in September 2015, into transition year, and this was hugely beneficial, and he excelled and joined in for the first time in a very long time. However, he constantly doubts his abilities and scores himself low with everything. He's about to start fifth year, and we're worried about who he hangs around with. His principal knows and supports our concerns and is keeping an eye on it. He said that our son is mannerly, kind and full of potential, but even he does raise an eyebrow at some of his friends. If he continues in this path, we don't hold out much hope for his Leaving Cert options. He has great regard for high achievers and puts them out of his reach. We feel those he picks as his friends are selected on purpose so as not to challenge him. What will we do?
Well, first of all, I'd be much less concerned about his Leaving Cert results than I would be about his self-confidence and self-esteem, which is best portrayed by his choice of friends from very early on in his life. At the youngest years, he chose a group of undesirables, so to speak. Poor achievers, young people who were marginalized, perhaps, young people who were engaging in activities that were less than savory, for which he quickly followed soon enough as a young teen. These are all troubling signs, and they really tell us and reveal to us exactly how he feels about himself, of lesser ability, of someone who is marginalized and who cannot succeed and cannot do things. Because what we know about peer group influence is interesting. Children are not seduced into a peer group so much as they join a peer group which most closely matches their own inner core self and identity. So we don't exactly join or get, we're not pulled into a peer group, we move towards one, based on how we feel about ourselves. So my concern for this young man would be what appears to be very poor self-confidence, perhaps a damaged self-esteem. There's been trouble in his life. They've caught him drinking and smoking at a young age, so that probably caused distress in the family. I'm sure there was a lot of argy-bargy around that. He probably could benefit from some counseling, I would think.
Okay.
Now, I don't know enough about the young fellow to really say, but the life history and the trajectory isn't a good one. And it isn't about Leaving Cert results here. That's much less important than where he will end up in life should he continue on this path of walking into the inappropriate reference groups, walking into the groups who underachieve, who are marginalized, who are engaged in troublesome, nettlesome, or difficult behaviors.
Self-esteem, what's important there? I mean, they say they have other children. They don't seem to have self-esteem issues. So how does one child suddenly present with low self-esteem issue?
Well, it can easily happen. We have to look at a lot of what we call predictive factors. For example, pregnancy, birth, delivery, infantile health, infant temperament. There's a whole host of things that make one child in any given family different from all the other children. No two are born alike. That's number one. Any parent who has two knows that right from the get-go. Children have different kinds of temperament. Temperament is the biological basis of our personality. Some are easy to rear. Some are prickly and bristle and oversensitive and not cuddly, etc. No two children, no two siblings are ever born into the same family. Interestingly enough, the arrival of every other child changes everything in thousands of different ways. So there are so many possible factors that could have influenced why this young man is a bit different from his sibs and why his self-esteem, if indeed that's the core problem, because it may not be, is different from everyone else. He probably could benefit from some counseling. I think a good counselor or therapist could help ferret out these ideas by speaking to parents and getting a lot of background information, and by talking to the young man himself and finding out why he's engaged in pursuing this particular lifestyle, of which he is largely consciously unaware, but is guiding him down a very unfortunate path in life, a path of underachievement and gravitating towards people that society doesn't particularly esteem.
Okay, setting low expectations on himself almost. 53106 for your text. The next one for you. Keen interest here as well. My 7-year-old daughter keeps hitting out when she's angry. She knows it's wrong. She feels terrible afterwards but says she can't control it. We have all looked at different ways for her to let off steam, like listening to music, punching a pillow, etc. But she goes from 0 to 10 in a second and she doesn't have time to use the practiced techniques. Please help. She is so upset about this.
Well, if she's upset about it, that means she's aware enough that what she's doing is wrong. That's a good sign. Thank God for that, because if she wasn't upset and didn't care, it points the arrow in different directions, which are very unhealthy. So she knows that she's doing wrong. She's trying to do better. First question that pops into my mind is maybe this is a child with a ADHD and a serious impairment of impulse control who goes very quickly from 0 to 10. We know that young people with ADHD, particularly the hyperactive impulsive type, flare up in an instant. There is no thinking between deed and action. It's sometimes been called the ready, fire, aim syndrome.
You know, good.
The aim comes after the fire. And that's what's happening with her. She's able to reflect on her activity, recognize that it's wrong, and feels bad about it. And she probably apologizes and wants to do better, but she can't. Now, parents have tried to implement some very appropriate kinds of techniques, but they're not working. I would wonder if they've been implemented long enough and consistently enough, because you can't use these techniques of, let's say, counting to 10 or deep breathing or whatnot once you're emotionally aroused. They're useless then. You need to practice them at quiescent times when you aren't in a state of high emotional arousal and distress, therefore eventually resetting the brain's mechanisms to be able to cope with frustration and difficulty more effectively. So that would be the first question I want to ask. How long have you been using these things? Mm. At what time are they being used? Are they being used consistently? What methods, in fact, are you using? There's some very good books for young children of this age. If you write into the show, I can get you the name. I can't think of the title right now, but they're workbooks for young people that look at all kinds of things, such as difficulty getting to bed. But one of them is what to do when you get angry too much, something like that.
Okay,
they can be used by parents to work with the children. They have art exercises in them and everything. They're wonderful books. Might be helpful.
If you give us the name, we will have their number and we'll get it onto them. We've David Carey with us. We'll be taking more of your questions, but we have a quick break to get out of the way. You're very welcome back. Tom Dunn sitting in for Sean today. David Carey, Child Psychologist and Dean at the College of Progressive Education, with us going through your queries. Some of the texts coming in for you, David. People with temper are fiery and passionate. That's not necessarily a bad thing, is it?
It depends what you do with it, of course. There's nothing wrong with being fiery and passionate. The Mediterranean region of Europe is filled with fiery and passionate people. But this little girl isn't just fiery and passionate. She's hitting other people, and that's a wrong thing to do.
I grew up in a terrible temper. I still have it. I find myself screaming out loud to myself when the house is empty to relieve the tension I feel. Once I've done this, I feel much better and can rationally think out the situation. That may not be the best technique, but it works for me, says Jer.
Get some counselling and you can deal more effectively with that.
Moving on, my son has started doing repetitive actions and saying things repeatedly, especially if he is stressed or overexcited. Is this OCD and does it require therapy, or will it resolve itself naturally?
Well, unfortunately, we don't know how old the son is. And that's a major omission here in the question. This may require assessment. Is it OCD? Probably not. Repetitive stereotyped actions, all the ones we typically associate with children on the autism spectrum, are signs of possible spectrum condition. So if that's the case, it does need assessment and investigation. Saying things repeatedly, especially when stressed or overexcited, is also a possible sign of a spectrum condition. So this needs assessment and some looking at. I wish I had more info,
okay,
in particular the age of the child. Go to your GP and highlight these things. Most in particular, best thing you can do, video some of the repetitive actions and also record some of the repetitive things he's saying. Show those to your GP. One look is worth a thousand tells, believe me. Nothing more illustrative than having a parent show you a video when they say, my child throws temper tantrums, or my child is out of control, or my child does this, that, or the other. When you see it, it absolutely crystallizes your mind as a clinician. So that would be my advice to these parents.
Next question for you is, we adopted our 7-year-old little boy and he is an only child. In play school and junior infants, the teacher called us in for his hitting and pushing of other kids. He has wiry strength, but it's not an out of control hitting, more of a spontaneous thump. He has been with the same group, small group of kids all the way up. He's a fun kid with a good sense of humour, but he seems emotionally younger than his peers. We invite his classmates to his house, but they either come and don't invite him back, or they don't come and they also tell tales on him in school. The teacher said no one would play with him, but kept an eye on him, said he seemed to have playmates. We went to a play therapist from October to January. We felt uncomfortable with her and her methods and never felt she eased his anxiety. His teacher was pushing us to have him assessed for hitting and pushing, and while he is doing well with reading and math, he is fidgeting instead of writing and colouring in. By the end of senior infants, the teacher said he couldn't get what he knew down on paper and it might come against him further down the line. He was jaw clenching before he went to see the play therapist, and this returned in June after a sleepover in his cousin's house. It is very severe now, and he clenches his neck and stomach muscles as if he is vomiting. It goes on all day from when he wakes until he sleeps. He has been to a HSE occupational therapist who placed him in the 75th percentile and said he doesn't need occupational therapy. He has also been to a psychologist, but we are still waiting on her report and what the next stage may be. What can we do? We need help, but don't feel play therapy is the way to go.
Play therapy probably isn't the way to go. This requires very thorough and comprehensive assessment, quite frankly. Now you've been to a psychologist, you must wait for the results, and that's unfortunate, but you will get them, and they could be very illustrative. Several things jump out at me here. One, this is a young boy who's been adopted, so I don't know how much we know about his birth background. And early years, at what age was he adopted, for example? Was he in an orphanage? Where is he from? Was he a very compromised baby? What was the health status of the mother and the father? These may be unanswerable questions, but they're important questions to at least ask and formulate. Number two, this jaw clenching and stomach clenching raises several concerns in my mind. I just am thinking of a diagnostic tree that's in my head. What branches would I be going down in terms of questions? Are we looking at possible tic disorder? because tics we usually associate with facial tics and whatnot. There are a huge number of possible tics, including very complex motor tics. Sometimes stomach clenching along those lines and neck clenching like that are tics. Now, are they signs of a genuine tic disorder or a transitory tic disorder or something like Tourette's? All of these things need investigation. Some of these symptoms also sound a little bit like some unusual and rather rare form of seizure conditions in young children. So what's coming up in my mind from this question, Tom, are hundreds of further questions that I can't answer. But what I think you need really is very comprehensive assessment. An OT assessment places him in the 75th percentile. For what? That doesn't tell me anything.
Didn't understand that either.
You know.
Yeah.
Was the OT assessment inclusive of sensory integration issues as opposed to just fine and motor skill issues? Because sometimes sensory integration issues and sensory processing cause all the symptoms we're looking at here. So we have poor self-regulation. We have difficulty acquiring some of the foundational aspects of literacy, perhaps. The jaw clenching, the stomach clenching. And unanswered questions on a psychological that will be revealed sooner
okay.
or later.
Sounds like they're on the right path, doesn't it? Because they've been to the psychologist. They're just waiting for the report.
Yeah, that's a very good start. And what often comes out of these assessments is more questions and a need for more assessment, unfortunately. I just have numerous questions in my mind about this seven-year-old.
Okay, for now, wait till you get the report.
Absolutely.
My 12-year-old son wets the bed. He has had four surgeries, the last of which was 3 years ago. The operations were not urological, but bowel-related. It was very stressful at the time. Could bed wetting be stress-related? We're using a bed wetting alarm for the last 2 months. We've seen no real change. We tried bladder training, holding urine for long periods, which had an effect for a while. He was doing well at school, has lots of friends, very active, or he has been doing well at school. Any suggestions?
Yeah, get rid of the bell thing there because that's really not going to be very useful. The bladder training is a very good exercise. Your basic Kegel exercises are very useful in strengthening all those muscles down there. Doing well at school, has loads of friends, is very active, fabulous. Bedwetter at 12. First question was about a 16-year-old boy who was a bedwetter up until 12. That happens. And in and of itself, it's not a sign or symptom of anything except bedwetting at age 12. Now, usually by age 13, it's gone away, although not always.
Okay.
Not a lot you can do about it, unfortunately. The bladder training, good idea. Keep him happy. No shaming. Give him some control over changing his bed linen when it happens. Have a fresh set of bed linen in the room for him where he can get it so he can quietly change. Put them in his hamper in his room. Doesn't have to waken mom or dad. No dignity issues there.
Okay.
The bedwetting problem, of course, can become a social problem if he's invited on sleepovers or goes away to a camp experience that's overnight. So we're going to hope that he develops out of that. He's had three surgeries, right? No, four surgeries. Surgical experiences for children under the age of 12. Now, he was 8 at the time of the last one, 9 or 8 or 9. That's a real trauma, real upset, particularly bowel surgery. And I don't know exactly what that means. Was that lower intestinal abdominal surgery or was it proctological? So there's possibility here that stress and upset could be feeding the problem. But the reality is most bedwetting isn't caused by stress.
Bedwetting itself, are there numbers involved in that should ring bells in your mind? You know,
what do you mean, man?
Some people have their children will stop, you know, wetting the bed by 2 or 3. Others it can be 5, 6, 7.
Yeah, this is the whole problem with children's development.
I know, as a parent, though, you're wondering, are my children amongst the latest ones, and are there reasons?
12
for
is
this?
Late.
12 is late. Yeah.
12 is late, but not uncommon, particularly among males.
Okay.
Believe it or not. So don't despair. Don't give up. It will probably go away within the next year.
Right.
If it doesn't, there isn't much you can do about it. I don't like the pad and the bell technique because that just disrupts sleep and doesn't do much. If he's aware that he's wet the bed, he'll get up, change the linen, all will be well, go back to sleep.
Frightens the life out of a child as well.
Restrict liquids, all that kind of stuff before bedtime.
of common sense. David, thank you very much indeed.
My pleasure, Tom.
Pleasure talking to you as always. David Carey there, child psychologist and dean at the College of Progressive Education.
Listen in every Wednesday at 3 p.m. here on Moncrief for more parenting advice from David Carey.